Well, I guess we're ready to begin this session. Yesterday we began our study by taking a look at the book of Daniel. First by taking a look at the man. We looked at the detailed description we have of what kind of young man Daniel must have been since he met the qualifications of the group that Nebuchadnezzar wanted collected by Ashpenaz. We took a look at his political rise not only among the Babylonians but among the Persians. And then we were taking a look at the book itself, how that Daniel stands alone among biblical books and that it is bilingual, half and half. We have some in Ezra, but nothing like we have in Daniel. How that Daniel is structured, as many of us already know, with the first half being narrative, the second half being apocalyptic prophecy, and how understanding that prophecy in Daniel is so important, not only to understanding the book of Revelation, but also other portions of the New Testament. And then we had gotten into the subject of Daniel's authenticity and how skeptics have raised the question of whether or not Daniel was in fact written by the man it claims to be and at the time it claims to be. There's no question but that the prophetic predictions in the latter book line up beautifully with secular history. And what the skeptic has done is he's recognized that. He's not denied it. He's just simply said, well, the book must have been written post-eventum, after the fact. That it's probably a second century book. And we talked about the various things that the skeptic will bring to bear on that question, how it's full of these sensational things, maybe miraculous things, and writing it off for that reason, which is not a logical argument at all. Saying it's full of historical inaccuracies. We pointed out that just because history doesn't mention things doesn't mean they didn't happen. That's obvious, and I think it was being discussed as Wade's class was closing from what I was hearing in the back area. And then we were talking about these Greek terms, or supposed Greek terms that are in the book, and how that it's awfully difficult in some scenarios to prove that something is Greek. But even if these are Greek terms, that's not a problem, because we know there was sufficient interaction between Asia Minor, Chaldea, Greece, and Persia, even before and during the captivity, to have brought about a knowledge of these things. So it doesn't prove that the writer is writing in 2nd century BC under Greek influence just because he may use Greek terms. Just like me using that instrument, whatever it was called, is not proof that I'm experiencing some direct influence from them. Cultures collide, they interact, and as people interact, things get shared. We're now ready to close our introduction by taking a look at some of the arguments that can be made in defense of the authenticity of the book, apart from answering those objections. And not all of them have equal force, but I'm just kind of going to go through the list I have in front of me. First, that Daniel is referenced as a historical person. For example, in the book of Ezekiel, as we saw, Ezekiel in chapters 14 and 28 is referencing Daniel. He's a contemporary of Daniel. This is 6th century BC stuff, and the Jews regarded Ezekiel as a book that belonged in the canon, as authentic. He's mentioning Daniel, and everything he says about Daniel lines up with what Daniel says about Daniel. So that's one piece of corroborative evidence. The Jews, I think this is more powerful. The ancient Jews always regarded Daniel as authentic. And this is an important point. They never called its genuineness or authenticity into question. The Jews, Pharisee and Sadducee alike, accepted the book of Daniel when they didn't accept other books that were written in that intertestamental period. Because, of course, the skeptics saying the book of Daniel was really written 2nd century B.C., well, other books that were written in that time period, like the books in the Apocrypha, the Jews did not accept. So why would they have rejected those and accepted the book of Daniel, especially with all its claims? It doesn't really seem to add up. Furthermore, there is evidence to suggest that the belief among many of the Jews, at least, was that during that intertestamental period, there were not prophets, or at least not a succession of them. First Maccabees is interesting in this regard, and I know most of us here maybe have a familiarity somewhat with First Maccabees. It's a Jewish book of history, and in many respects a very reliable one. In First Maccabees chapter 4, verse 46, the Jews were cleansing the temple, and they had the altar, remember, that had been defiled by Antiochus Epiphanes. If that doesn't mean anything to you now, Lord willing, it will next week. And instead of trying to cleanse that altar, they just decided to dismantle it and put a new one in its place. But of course, we've got the stones from this altar that was sacred to God. What are we going to do with these stones? We can't just pitch them. They didn't feel like. So So 1 Maccabees 4:46 says they laid up the stones of that altar in the mountain of the temple in a convenient place until there should come a prophet to show what should be done with them. We don't have a prophet now, but we know one's coming, and when he comes, we'll see what he says about this. But it's interesting, confirming this idea among them. 1 Maccabees 14:41, again, concerning this time in between the Testaments, they were concerning making Simon a man high priest, and it says, the Jews and priests were well pleased that Simon should be their governor and high priest until there should arise a faithful prophet. So not only do you have the Jews rejecting, accepting Daniel, but you have them rejecting things during that intertestamental period when people say the book of Daniel was written. So it doesn't really add up. They didn't seem to have viewed that as a time when they could get a book that would go into the canon. Josephus writes, interestingly, about this view. The prophets, he says, wrote from Moses to Artaxerxes during the Persian period, very particularly. But the later writers, he says, have not been esteemed of the like authority with the former of our forefathers because, he says, there has not been an exact succession of prophets since that time. The Talmud says, after the latter prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the Holy Spirit departed from Israel. So if that is, in fact, the view of the Jew, then they wouldn't have accepted anything written in the time that the skeptic says Daniel was written. Material from Daniel is alluded to and considered genuine history in the book of Maccabees. Again, 1 Maccabees chapter 2, verses 59 and 60, mentions the three Hebrew children, Ananias, Azarias, and Mishael, by believing were saved out of the flame, it writes. Daniel, for his innocency was delivered from the mouth of lions. Here's a second century book, and it's referencing these events in Daniel as if they were real history. It does so again in 1 Maccabees chapter 1. The book of Daniel was included in the Septuagint. Does anyone happen to remember the king who commissioned the translation of the Septuagint? Ptolemy Philadelphus. We'll be talking about him next week, hopefully. Ptolemy Philadelphus was Ptolemy down in Egypt, a forefather of the Cleopatra that we're so familiar with. And he made a deal, an arrangement with the Jews, as the tradition goes anyway. Josephus records this, that six elders were sent down from each of the 12 tribes up in Israel, and they came and supposedly in 72 days got the whole Old Testament translated. This was about 250 B.C. Now, not all scholars buy into that. Some are saying that the Septuagint may have been started then, but was translated over a longer period of time. And that may or may not be, but Daniel's in there. Again, suggesting if it is back here in the 3rd century B.C. that Daniel is much older than the skeptic is wanting to say. And another piece of evidence. Josephus tells the story of how when Alexander the Great came into Jerusalem in about 332 B.C. that he was shown the book of Daniel. He writes, Alexander came into the city, and when he had offered sacrifice to God according to the high priest's direction, and magnificently treated both the high priest and the priests, the book of Daniel was shown him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians. And of course, Alexander supposed that that was he himself, and he was very glad to hear it. But Josephus is telling us, it predated Alexander. They already have it. He writes again, discussing the prophecies in Daniel 8, he says, indeed, it so came to pass that our nation suffered these things under Antiochus Epiphanes, according to Daniel's vision, and what he wrote many years before they came to pass, many years before the 2nd century B.C. Let me bring up just a few more things before we move on. There is a precision of detail in the book of Daniel which argues against a 2nd century writer. It reads like it was written by someone who was in ancient Babylonian culture rather than someone who's in Judea 3.5 centuries later. Daniel, for example, in chapter 2, is very detailed about the magi castes among the Babylonians. He mentions the Chaldeans, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers. Archaeological evidence has confirmed the accuracy of his record here. Daniel, interestingly, three times in his book refers to the law of the Medes and Persians. You think, well, that's not significant at all. Yet, in Esther's time, later on, we read of the laws of the Persians and the Medes. And 1 Maccabees does the same thing. Now, what's going on there? Well, Daniel reveals this to us. The Medes were the dominant people at first, but over time the Persians took the dominant role, and later parlance reflected that. It wasn't the Medes and the Persians anymore. When the Maccabees talk about it and when Esther talks about it, it's the Persians and the Medes. But Daniel writes of the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Now, if he's writing hundreds of years later, that's a pretty subtle nuance to think to include in your supposed forgery. That suggests that he's right in the heart of this, right in the middle of this. He mentions how that Shushan was in the province of Elam in chapter 8, verse 2. The provinces would be changed in the future times, and the boundary relocations, that is, and Shushan would be in the province of Susiana. Now, Daniel's supposedly writing very much later, according to these skeptics, and yet he knows to include it in the province of ancient times. And then, most conclusive argument is that Jesus references Daniel. In Matthew 24, Jesus speaks of Daniel not only as a historical figure, Matthew 24:15, but as a prophet, as a reliable prophet. And when he speaks of the abomination of desolation, interestingly, he uses the exact word-for-word Greek phrase that appears in the Greek translation of Daniel in Daniel chapter 12, verse 11, and then similar expressions in 9 and 11. So all of these things, of course, speak to what we already believe, that we've got a book here that is from God. The evidence for its genuineness is compelling, and anyone who denies it does so in spite of the evidence, not in light of it. One final thing. Thomas Paine, he's got a great reputation in America when it comes to revolutionary history. These are the times that try men's souls. But Thomas Paine was not a believer. And he wrote a work entitled The Age of Reason, in which he spoke against Scripture. And in that work, interestingly, he raises the question of the authorship of Ezekiel and Daniel. And I myself have not read the work itself. I've got this quote elsewhere, but it's interesting to see what he has written. He wrote, quote, "Are they genuine? That is, were they written by Ezekiel and Daniel? I am more inclined to believe that they were than that they were not. The manner in which the books ascribed to Ezekiel and Daniel are written agrees with the condition these men were in at the time of writing them." Here's a doubter, here's a skeptic, but he acknowledges that the things do seem to line up. Historically, it seems to fit. Now, how you can say that and then deny the rest of the book, I don't quite figure. But we'll find ways to ignore things if we want to. That's all I intend to say, and I want to get into the text unless you have any comments or questions. Well, let's open up to the book of Daniel if you're not there already. Daniel chapter 1, we looked at quite a bit of this yesterday, but let's go ahead and just read through it. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, this is about 606, 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the house of his God. Now these articles Nebuchadnezzar takes, we know, are in the future returned when Cyrus issues the decree that they can return. They bring them back with them. Ezra chapter 1, verses 9 and 11 enumerates these. There were 30 gold platters, 1,000 silver platters, and so on. Some valuable stuff here, and it was eventually returned, but here's when we begin to see the temple plundered, and each captivity it got worse until it had been taken altogether. Nebuchadnezzar is said to take these things to the land of Shinar. Where's the first place we encounter Shinar in the Scriptures? Genesis chapter 10. Nimrod founded his kingdom with Shinar. Shinar is mentioned in Genesis chapter 11 as the location of the Tower of Babel, which was part, again, of Nimrod's kingdom. Genesis 14, we have Amraphel, king of Shinar. He's one of those four kings that came against Sodom and Gomorrah, remember, before Lot was taken out and his family and Abraham had to save him. Nimrod is mentioned four times in the book of Genesis, three times in the prophets, here, of course, and then over in Isaiah and in Zechariah. The appearance in Zechariah is interesting. We don't have time to go through that, but in Zechariah 5, we have got those eight visions of Zechariah's right at the beginning of the book. And in Zechariah 5, remember there's this ephah, the basket. And in that basket is this woman. And Zechariah is told, this is wickedness. And the woman is thrust down into that basket. The lead lid is put on top. And these two women with wings of a stork come and pick that up between heaven and earth and carry it all the way over to Shinar and set it on its base. That's where wickedness belongs. Wickedness belongs in Shinar, not among my people, is at least part of the message of that vision. And Shinar, of course, is where Babylon was. And to make that clear, 2 Chronicles 36, verse 7, when the same event is recorded, it says, Nebuchadnezzar carried some of the articles from the house of the Lord to Babylon to put them in his temple at Babylon. So Shinar is the home of the city of Babylon. Albert Barnes interestingly points out that Shinar would have been the vernacular name of the location. In other words, this is what the natives would have called it, that a foreigner would have referred to it as Babylonia. And that's interesting if that's true, that this is one more piece of proof that Daniel's right here. He's speaking this language. He's dealing with these people, and he's speaking of the region in terms of how they would speak of it. Daniel says that Nebuchadnezzar takes these treasures, these things from the house of God, to the house of his God. His God would have been Bel, identified also with Marduk. The Jews called Marduk Merodach. I don't know how many of you have looked extensively into the belief systems of these idolatrous peoples. It gets very confusing. It overlaps. You've got one people believing in Hadad, one people believing in Baal, one people believing in Bel, perhaps, and these things all intertwine themselves. I mean, Bel, is it Bel or is it Marduk? Are these different gods? Are they the same gods? Are identified with each other? It's just all very confusing. But Bel was the patron god of Babylon. He was the head of the Babylonian pantheon. He is related to Baal. The names do have some connection. He's mentioned three times in the Old Testament. Jeremiah 50 verse 2 links him. Jeremiah 50 verse 2 links him to Babylon. Babylon is taken. Bel is shamed, says Jeremiah chapter 50 verse 2. Nebuchadnezzar takes the articles from the house of the one true and living God, takes them to the house of Bel, and notice it says there, into the treasure house of his God. Well, what's going on there? Into the house of his God, into the treasure house of his God. This is interesting. It was common for heathen temples to be also the treasure houses of the kings. Now, these two, you know, what does the spiritual have to do with the physical? But here they brought the two together because the two were very related. And this sort of thing continued for centuries. I was reading a book of history to my children, I don't know, 6-8 months ago, and we were reading about the Roman Empire, and I came across this quote. Temples to the gods, and this is Roman cities, temples to the gods also served as banks. There, money changers and merchants looked for customers. Isn't that interesting? So we come to John chapter 2, and here they are, the money changers. Where'd they get this idea? Well, they were doing what Romans do. This was perfectly natural. You get the bank, you connect it with the temple, and you hear, and you come to get your loan, or whatever. It didn't belong there, but it was common among the heathen. And all the way back here we're going to take these treasures and we're going to take them to the treasure house of my God. Verse 3, of course, Nebuchadnezzar told his master, the master of his eunuchs, gather up these young men. And in verse 5, let's just skip verse 4. Verse 5, the king appointed for these men a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. A daily provision of the king's delicacies. Now, this no doubt would have been regarded as a very high privilege and benefit to many. I mean, this is what Nebuchadnezzar's eating. This is the best of the best. And I'm going to share this with these future servants of mine. The King James says king's meat, the ASV king's dainties, the NAS king's choice food, the ESV and NIV are much more general. I don't know precisely what it was, but it was food fit for a king, a pagan king anyway. And it would have been regarded as, hey, this is great. But, of course, we know Daniel did not so regard it. Notice in verse 5 also, it wasn't just meat, though, or these delicacies. They were also being given what else? Wine. And Daniel's going to reject that as well. 3 years of training, during which time they would have this to eat, if they followed through with the original plan. Verse 6, now from among those, of course, were these four men. Verse 7, to them the chief of the eunuchs gave name. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. Now, yesterday I pointed out how that the name Daniel means judge of God. He comes into Babylon and his name is changed. Daniel, El, meaning God. He's judge of God, but now he's Belteshazzar. He's named after a pagan god. He's now Bel's prince, the prince whom Bel favors. That must have been a rather unpleasant experience to have your name changed and be forced to go by the name of this false god. Same thing happens to Hananiah. Hananiah means whom Jehovah gave, or Jah has favored. And by the way, when you see Jah or Yah, this is just a contracted form of Jehovah or Yahweh. In Psalm 68, verse 4, we actually see this name used for God in the English text. Sing to God, sing praises to His name, extol Him who rides on the clouds, by His name, Yah. And we see that three times in the book of Isaiah. And it's reflected in lots of biblical names. Elijah, Abijah, Hezekiah, Zechariah, Hananiah. Here it is. He's got the name of God in his name. And by the way, this is the exact same name as the Greek Ananias. Same name. His name is changed to Shadrach. Shadrach. According to Brown Driver Briggs, this may refer to the god Aku. The command of Aku may be the meaning of this name. So he goes from having the name of God to the name of the Babylonian moon god. Just like Daniel has to endure a pagan name, a false god's name being given to him. Mishael, which means who is that which God is. Kind of an odd thing, but that seems to be the meaning. His name is changed to Meshach, who is what Aku is, the moon god. Wow, we'll just take the name, we'll tweak it a little bit. We'll take God's name out of it, and we'll put Aku in. Azariah, his name means Jah has helped, or whom Jehovah aids. He gets the name Abednego. And it's thought that Nego here may be connected to Nebo. This is another false god. And you see this name in a number of names you're familiar with. If you have that sheet among the charts I gave you in your notebook, and you see the names of the Babylonian kings there, you'll see this. Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar, they're the last king of Babylon. Nabonidus, this is all a reflection of this god. And here, Abednego, or maybe how he would have rather have been known, Azariah gets that name. And by the way, I try to say Abednego. It's harder to say, that's why we say Abednego. Abednego is technically how... maybe a little more correct. I remember I got in the habit of trying to say it the right way in that song, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I never had anyone question that until I was holding a VBS at Old Lamine. This little, I don't know, 5, 6, 7-year-old girl. She raises her hand. It's Abednego. So I got corrected by someone small. She was cute, but she was wrong. It's Abednego. You know, the question does come up, why... why is Nebuchadnezzar doing this? Why is he changing the names of these men? Well, he's trying to strip them of their identity. Okay, yeah, that's probably part of it. But you know, there's an instance that Nebuchadnezzar did this in besides these men, which raises the question still. If you want to turn over there, in 2 Kings 24, Nebuchadnezzar changed the name of another Jew, but he doesn't follow the same pattern that we see him following here in Daniel chapter 3. It concerns the last king of Judah, who, by the way, if you're not there yet, what was the last king of Judah? What was his name? Zedekiah. 2 Kings 24:17 says, "Then the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, Jehoiachin's uncle, king in his place, and changed his name to Zedekiah." Well, Mattaniah means gift of Jah, gift of Yah. Okay, what's Zedekiah mean? What false god's in that? There's no false god in that name. Zedekiah means the justice of Jehovah, the right of Yah. Now, there are a couple things we can say about that. Number one, when you take Jews and you put them in Babylon, you give them the names of Babylonian God. When you have a Jew still in Israel, you keep his name in harmony with the beliefs of that area. But still, then why choose his name? Why change his name? And I alluded to this on Sunday in my lesson. I think what may be behind this is simply a show of authority. I have power over you, so much so I'm going to name you. Just like Adam named the animals, just like he named Eve, here's this show of authority. I mean, who of us wants our name changed against our will? You know, I can't think of a circumstance in which it would happen, but if you were forced to go by a name other than the one you have and the one that's been yours for years. None of us would like that. A name is very dear. And this is a show of authority. Necho did this also to one of the kings of Judah. 2 Kings 23:24. Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in his place, in place of his father Josiah, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. Let's look now at verse 8. So these men have this name change now. And Daniel, finding himself in a very difficult situation, maybe only, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, taken away from his home, who knows where his parents are, being forced to learn a language and literature he may have no interest in. Yeah, Richard.
Do you have any idea why we continue to call Daniel, and the other three by their Babylonish names?
I'm guessing it's just a reflection of the frequency in the text, that those other three go by their Babylonian names far more often than they do their Hebrew names. We've got this third chapter and they're going by those Babylonian names the whole time. Well, the time where they're going by their Aramaic names is in the Aramaic portion of that book, which may have been intended to communicate to a broader audience. Maybe that would have helped make it a little easier to read and listen to. I can speculate all day. No, I don't know, ultimately. Yes, James. Yes. Yes. I don't know why that is. If anyone thinks you have an answer, I'm open.
I think that's the answer to the question, because that's how they're referred to in Daniel. Daniel refers to Daniel.
Oh,
yeah.
But as to the reason why they're referred to those other names, that's the... Okay. Okay. Yeah. I think there's something to that. Okay. Daniel, verse 8, purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Daniel does what we all need to do. He makes a decision. He makes a determination in his heart that whatever the cost, I'm going to do the will of God. And he determines, I'm not going to defile myself. Now the question does rise, what about this food would have caused him to defile himself? And I can't nail that down. It may have been that some of this meat was meat outside of the framework of God's ordination. Maybe there was pork involved. It may be that this meat had been strangled, in which case the blood had been trapped and they're not supposed to be eating blood. Even the Gentiles shouldn't have been doing that. It may be that some of this meat, all or in part, had been offered to idols in some respect. Or it may have been a combination of those things. But whatever it was, he saw this as causing him to disobey God. So he makes this decision, I'm not going to do it. And he resolves to take action. How many of us have found ourselves in circumstances where we were being faced with doing something wrong and we fretted about it, we let it bother us, but we took no action? Daniel's not going to sit by here and let his conscience eat at him. I'm going to do something about this. And he handles it well. He goes here to the chief of the eunuchs, and notice it says he requests. He requests. He doesn't go in here and saying, all right, listen, I'm a Jew and I'm not going to eat what you have. And you say, well, that would have got him killed. Well, maybe. But still, a soft answer turns away wrath. You're going to get more flies with honey than you are with vinegar. He goes and he makes a request. And the answer to the request is not what he wanted. Verse 9, God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs, as a similar situation with Joseph. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink, for why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. All right? I don't share your religion. I don't share your convictions. What I share is a concern for my own head. As far as I know, this is the way to go. You're wanting me to alter that, and I'm not convinced it's going to work. And if it doesn't work, I'm on the block. Now, if you're Daniel, what do you? If you're in Daniel's situation, what do you do now? You start arguing, right? Now, wait a minute. You need to see things my way. There's no indication Daniel does that. Daniel does not ask this man to risk his neck for convictions that are not his own. And that's an interesting thing to consider. We need to risk our neck for our convictions that are in harmony with the will of God. But it's not our place to call others to do that. Here's a Gentile. I'm not going to ask him to live by my law. So, he could just say, okay, well, I gave it a try. I tried, right? I went out of my way. I did something that the other guys wouldn't do. I went and I asked. I got told no. I hope the Lord will surely understand and be merciful. No. Verse 11, Daniel said to the steward, he goes to lower management, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies, and as you see fit, so deal with your servants. So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. The easiest government to manage and get help from is government that's closest to you. So he goes to the guy that the chief of the eunuchs has put over him, someone between middle management, lower management. Can I get some help from you? And notice again how he goes about it. He doesn't ask this guy to risk his neck. Give me 10 days. 10 days. And I'm not asking you to import meat from anywhere. I'm not asking you to kill yourself. Look, I'll make this as easy as possible. Just give us vegetables and water. And by the way, I know the King James translates that word pulse, which doesn't sound very appetizing to me. Gesenius says this stuff just means vegetables, herbs, such as would be eaten in like a half fast as opposed to flesh. So I think this might be a very broad term, anything that would not be meat. It could be fruits, vegetables, grains, all of these things. And just let us eat these things. We'll have water. We don't want the wine. I don't know that why precisely Daniel makes that decision. It's not for kings. Remember what the Scripture says. It's not for kings to drink alcohol. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is a brawler. We'd just rather not even get started on that road. Just keep the wine away from us. We'll go with water. Give it to us for 10 days. And the man agrees. Okay, all right, I'll give you 10 days. If it doesn't work out, we're going right back to the other way. But I'll give you 10 days. They run the test in verse 14. He consented with them in this manner and tested them 10 days. In verse 15, at the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Now, the word fatter means just that, literally at least. Fatter, plump, fattened, fat are the words I come across. I don't know if we're still to take that literally, though. The NIV renders it better nourished, and that might be the idea, that there's just an appearance of better nourished. Maybe the food they were eating, although much liked, was somehow nutritionally deficient. I don't know, but they look better. They look healthier after eating this diet. And, of course, the steward is sold on it, and everyone gets to eat Daniel's diet, and you wondered how the others felt about that. But it works. Now, the question is, was this miraculous? I don't know. I don't know. And I'll throw this out. Don't ask me to do it during this meeting. But I'm game if one or more of you would like to try this at some point, maybe before year's out. I'm game. I'll do it for 10 days. Let's pick a day. Let's get a before picture. And let's just do... Let's find out! I mean, everyone wants to say, oh, it's miraculous. Well, that's because you don't want to try it. Let's put aside the sweets and all that stuff. Let's do it for 10 days. And we'll see what happens. I was in a Bible study not too long ago where we were looking at this chapter, and a couple of individuals decided they would try it. And they ran into a hitch pretty quickly, because this is going to be hard to do. I mean, day-to-day living. This is outside of the norm. But one of the ladies in the study, she really had some strong doubts about my idea that this might really just be a natural thing. And I guess she maybe went and talked to somebody in the medical profession, and there could be just something very natural and physical material at work here. So anyway, I throw that out. I don't want to do it by myself, but I might do it with one or more of you, just to see what would happen. Just to see what would happen.
John,
yes. Thank you. Yeah. Because even as easy as Daniel's making it on him, it's still going to cause him to have to go out of his way a little bit. That's true. All right. Verse 18. Well, let's start at verse 17. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now, at the end of the days, the 3 years are over now, at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Now, this may be kind of like a graduation day, or this is the day where your doctorate's going to be, you know, grilled and see if you can stand the test, but we're brought before the king. Verse 19, the king interviewed them. He talks with them. And, you know, I don't know all that this entailed, but this may say a lot about Nebuchadnezzar. The Nebuchadnezzar was a man, he wasn't just some brute warrior that didn't have much sense. He was a man who could interview these men and make good judgments about who was competent, who wasn't, who was the best to serve me and who wasn't. That shows some competency and some intelligence on the part of this man. He interviews them, and of course, among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they served before the king. And that expression, before the king, is the same expression that appears over in Genesis 41:46 concerning Joseph. Joseph stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, my New King James says, but it's the same Hebrew expression. So there's some approximation here. They're in touch with the king. They're serving perhaps in the court. Just precisely what they're doing, I don't know, but they're brought here to serve before him. And in all matters of wisdom, verse 20 says, and understanding, about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better. I think that's probably hyperbole, but much better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. And this verse 20 is our first exposure to these magicians and astrologers. We're going to see them again in chapter 2. The word for magician here is the same word used in Exodus of Jannes and Jambres over in Exodus chapter 7. Strong identifies it as a horoscopist. He says as drawing magical lines or circles. Gesenius says it refers to sacred scribes who are skilled in sacred writing, like hieroglyphics. The root of the word is a pen. So it seems like it might have something to do with, you know, again, like the sacred writing or some kind of designs that were somehow related to the occult and thought to have power. Whatever these men were doing, Young's literally even translates it scribes. The common translation today is magicians. And then these astrologers. I talked about how the Babylonians were known for their astrology. That doesn't seem to be the idea here. Most translations render this enchanters, conjurers. The Hebrew word carries with it the idea of just practicing enchantment. I admit, I don't understand all the distinctions between these various castes, but we've just got the occult at work. And by the way, you know, this is on the rise in our country. My very first experience with witchcraft, where I got exposed to it, was in Springfield, where I was going to school here all the way back in 93, late 93, early 94. Some of you heard me tell this story. I mean, this young man, his name was Seth, nice Bible name, nice guy. We were in a communication class together, and we were supposed to go interview. You're supposed to match up with someone and go interview each other and write a paper about it. So I go to Seth's dorm room, and we're talking, and he starts telling me about how he's a white witch, how he saw a guy turn into a wolf and told him, you know, you got to be careful because you're going the bad way when that sort of thing happens. And he whipped out his tarot cards, very serious about this, had really bizarre ideas about the nature of God. Paganism has been on the rise in the UK for quite a long time, and I got my eyes opened at the camp out. I was teaching the junior high class, and the idea of the Greek gods came up, and I never would have planned to ask the kids this question, but based on something one of them said, I said, how many of you know, these are junior high students, how many of you know people who believe in the Greek gods? 3 of them raised their hand. 3 of them. Now maybe I am just lost in my little world where I'm out of touch with this, but that surprised me. I was having a conversation with a young man, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago, maybe less, where he had grown up among us and has walked away, and he was telling me, yeah, I believe in deity, but maybe it's the Greek gods, maybe this or that. And I you know, this guy's not taking this seriously, and I don't think he was. But to find out that the young generation now is growing up believing this stuff. I'm not very old, and this stuff was hocus pocus mythology when I was in school. To think we've got people actually beginning to take this seriously. So we're on our way there. And this stuff we're reading about, which seems so far away and so ancient and so outside of our realm of experience, you know, we've got people here in this building who may grow up seeing this much more along the norm. We know that astrology has been getting used by those in Wall Street for a long time, but doesn't really give us much confidence. But It's out there and it's growing. It says at the end of the chapter, Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. This first year of Cyrus is mentioned four other times in the Old Testament, all in conjunction with that decree that you can go back to Judah. The dates differ, 538, 536, but this does not mean that Daniel continued only until the first year of King Cyrus. And how do we know that? What's that? Yeah, there it is. Over in chapter 10, he has that vision, chapters 10, 11, and 12, in the third year of Cyrus. So I think the idea here may be simply that Daniel lived to see the transition of government. He lived to see them go from Babylonian to Persian. But he would, of course, live beyond that. Just how long, I don't know. But that's all I have on the first chapter. Anything anyone wants to add before we move on to chapter 2? We're probably going to be in chapter 2 a little while, and then we'll cruise through, hopefully, 3, 4, 5, and 6 faster. But what we're getting started on today, we'll be here a little while. Keith?
John, Daniel also has a pretty interesting example in the first chapter of how to deal with conflict.
Mm-hmm.
When you're put into a position where in order to do what you believe God wants you to do, you have to be, that brings you into conflict with the government or with someone else. People like to talk about compromise at times. Daniel compromised, but in compromising, he didn't move. He worked with the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, people respond more radically in times of opposition rather than to follow the pattern of Daniel or St. Joseph or someone else. I think it's a valid point to observation maker.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I admit my inclination when a rule is made that I don't like or I think is unreasonable, particularly with government, is to really balk and to kind of want to fight the system. And sometimes the best way to win is the very sort of thing you're talking about. Trying to come across very gently and trying to find out how we can find an agreement that's going to be a win-win for both sides. Daniel wasn't asking too much. Just give me 10 days and we make it easy on you and see if it can work for both of us. And we do need to try to do that. And for some of us, that might be harder to learn than others, but we do need to try to deal with conflict that way.
It's consistent throughout the first six chapters of the book that no matter what, Daniel maintains his integrity and behaves in the book in a godly manner. We need to maintain the same integrity in all aspects of our life.
That's true. Amen. Yes, Steve.
Regarding verse 16 of chapter 1, were you suggesting that from that time forward, all of the young men at the school of training of the king were fed vegetables or just the poor Hebrew?
That is what I was suggesting. Are you of a different opinion?
Well, I don't know. It just seems to me that it's applying to the ones that started on that diet in the first place, in the context. So Daniel and his friends
okay.
On that diet for their portion.
Yeah, I don't want to be dogmatic about it. You may be right. I guess as I'm looking at it, though, their portion of delicacies, in one sense, had maybe already kind of been taken away, hadn't it? I mean, they're already doing something different. And then in verse 17, it says, as for these four young men, as if it were a different body of people than the previous verse. Okay. Okay, all right. Maybe that's right. Anything else? All right, chapter 2. Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Now is there anything about that first verse that strikes you as unusual, those of you who pay attention to dates? The second year of King Nebuchadnezzar. How long has it been at least since Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem? It's been at least three, right? I mean, he got these strong young men and they went through 3 years of training. They've already been interviewed and now given their position. So at least 3 years have passed, and yet we're reading here about the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. What's going on? Well, I think the answer may simply be about how we count time. And this is one example, perhaps, of where the same king's same reign is counted differently by different people. Nebuchadnezzar had actually reigned conjointly with his father, Nabopolassar, for 2 years, between 606 and 604 B.C., But his father died, and then he began his reign individually as a king, and that's probably what this is referring to, that this is the second year of his individual reign. He has reigned altogether 5 years, some with his father, some alone, but only 2 years as an individual. And then we've got about 4 years now since Daniel's been taken. He has this dream, and he's so troubled he can't sleep. Now, Pharaoh was troubled by his dream over in Genesis 41:8, but we don't have him not being able to sleep. Nebuchadnezzar can't sleep. And Nebuchadnezzar is not the kind of man to put things off. He wants an answer. And it looks like maybe he rouses others from their sleep. I want an answer. I want it now. Go wake up the astrologers, magicians, Chaldeans. Get them up and get them in here. And I want some help. So they're brought in verse 2. The king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. All right, we saw the magicians and the astrologers in chapter 1, verse 20. The sorcerers here, this is translated sorcerers almost across the board. Maybe those who used magical songs, muttered incantations. And then we've got this group called the Chaldeans, and I would like to spend a little time on them. This last group in the verse, the Chaldeans, almost all translations render this Chaldeans, but if you're reading out of the NIV, how does it render it? Astrologers. Astrologers. Now, I admittedly do not think that's a reflection of the original in the strictest sense, but if you look up Unger on this, in Unger's Bible Dictionary, it's interesting, he has a heading, Chaldean Astrologers, and he speaks to this group of people, and if you'll bear with me, I'd like to read you what he writes. Because of their proficiency in the science of astronomy and their skillful practice of astrology, the Chaldeans became a special caste of astrologers. So they're called the Chaldeans, but they are in fact a group of astrologers. From 625 BC onward, the Chaldeans held complete sway in Babylonia. The city of Babylon was their capital, was the center of intellectual life in all Western Asia, and this intellectual activity was used especially in the study of the stars, both scientific and as a means of divination. Astronomy and astrology were both sought after in the land, hence Babylon became famous as the home of all sorts of magicians, sorcerers, diviners, and other occultists. And just as an aside, the Chaldeans kept detailed records of the stars for more than 360 years, and one of their most astounding contributions was that they reckoned the year as being 365 days, 6 hours, 15 minutes, 41 seconds. Now, how you do that, I have no idea, but they did. And it's only 30 minutes off from what our modern instruments have been able to calculate. So their information gathering was very good, and they were able to deduce quite a bit from it. But it does look like these Chaldeans were, in fact, some version of astrologers, reading the stars, making deductions from that. Well, when you were born, this is what this constellation was doing, therefore this is what's going to happen in your life, and so forth. We see this sort of approach among pagans all the time. We've already talked a little bit about this. We know the Babylonians had these priests called the Baru. They would look at oil and water in a cup. They'd watch the flight of birds. They'd interpret dreams and all sorts of things to supposedly get some peek into the other world as to what was going to happen in this one. Interestingly, in Ezekiel 21, Nebuchadnezzar is referenced before the temple was destroyed. And in Ezekiel 21:21, God says, "The king of Babylon stands at the parting of the road, at the fork of two roads, to use divination. He shakes the arrows. He consults the images. He looks at the liver." They'd look at the liver of these sacred animals, you know, to supposedly get some information. Nebuchadnezzar was doing this, at least before his experiences that are recorded for us in the book of Daniel. God commanded the nation of Israel to not get wrapped up in this, you know, before they went into the promised land. In Deuteronomy 18, God says, "I'll give you a prophet. You'll have prophets who you'll know speak the truth, and you can go to them, but don't get wrapped up in this nonsense that the heathen are involved in," although they did. Now,
hey, John.
Yes, Steve.
I think it's the latest issue of National Geographic.
Yes. How long will it be before we see it here in the limelight? I don't know. Did you have something, Jeannie? Ezekiel 21:21. All right. Now, I would prefer not to get off on a discussion about this, what I'm about to say. Not because I'm afraid of discussion, it's just that I don't know that the discussion would be profitable. You know, when I read Exodus, the natural reading of that, and that doesn't mean it's the right reading, but it does seem like the natural reading is that Jannes and Jambres really were doing something. That they were succeeding in accomplishing, to a limited extent, through their power, from wicked sources, what God was doing through Moses. Now, there might be those in this room who disagree with me, and you may be right, but that just seems to be the natural reading. And I bring that up only because I am at this point, and maybe it's my weakness, but I'm at this point not prepared to say that all of the occult is hocus pocus. I don't know. There may be something to some of it. Whether there is or not, though, we do know that in that world there is a lot of charlatanism. And I think that at least some of these men, if not all of them, were in that business. That's probably why Nebuchadnezzar responds to them the way he does a little later in the chapter. Look, you tell me the dream, and then I'll know you can interpret it. And if you can't tell me the dream, I'm going to be done with you. He is fed up with the hocus pocus. He wants something real. I have an article here in front of me, and I got tipped off onto this by listening to someone else who was teaching this book. But this article is called Cold Reading, How to Convince Strangers That You Know All About Them. It comes from the Skeptical Inquirer in 1977. And basically what it's talking about is these people who practice, you know, you come in, they got the little clear crystal ball or a palm reading, and you come in and suddenly they're able to tell you these things, which, how do they know these things? And it's an art. It's a very practiced art. And they're able to gather an enormous amount of information about you, but just by being careful about observation. If you'll bear with me, I'd like to read some of this to you. Cold reading, quote unquote, is a procedure by which a reader is able to persuade a client whom he has never before met that he knows all about the client's personality and problems. Now, these people start off with basic assumptions that, you know, all people have a certain number of similarities, and they use that. But then he says the cold reader goes beyond these. He gathers as much additional information about the client as possible. Sometimes such information is obtained in advance of the reading. If the reading is through appointment, the reader can use directories and other sources to gather information. When the client enters the consulting room, an assistant can examine the coat left behind, and often the purse as well, for papers, notes, labels, and other such cues about socioeconomic status, and so on. Most cold readers, though, he says, don't need such advanced information. Bear with me a little bit longer. The cold reader basically relies on good memory and acute observation. The client is carefully studied. The clothing, for example, style, neatness, cost, age, provides a host of cues for helping the reader make shrewd guesses about this person. The client's physical features, weight, posture, looks, eyes, and hands provide further cues. The hands are especially revealing to the good reader. I don't know how, but that's what it says. What these readers will do is, you know, they'll start trying to make these educated guesses, and then they watch your response. And if he is on the wrong track, his client's reactions, eye movements, pupillary dilation, and otherly bodily mannerisms warn him, and so he tweaks it. They're watching all these things. And one other thing I wanted to read to you. Remember, the key ingredient of a successful character reading is confidence. If you look and act as if you believe in what you are doing, you will be able to sell even a bad reading to most of your subjects. And I believe that. I believe that. There is power in apparent conviction. People really get bamboozled by that in religion as well as other areas. This man said, though, this is the last thing I wanted to read to you. One danger of playing the role of reader is that you will persuade yourself that you really are divining true character. He says, this happened to me. I started reading palms when I was in my teens as a way to supplement my income from doing magic and mental shows. When I started, I did not believe in palmistry, palm reading, I assume. But I knew that to sell it, I had to act as if I did. After a few years, I became a firm believer in palmistry. One day, and this is really good, one day, the late Dr. Stanley Sachs, who was a professional mentalist and a man I respected, tactfully suggested that I would make an interesting experiment if I deliberately gave readings opposite to what the lines indicated. I tried this out with a few clients. To my surprise and horror, my readings were just as successful as ever. Ever since then, I have been interested in the powerful forces that convince us, reader and client alike, that something is so when it really isn't. And he also goes on to say about how using a gimmick is helpful. it can give a sense of, well, it has an effect. Now, here's this gimmick. I got to look at this ball or whatever. And it also allows you to buy time. Let me think. Now, what am I going to say? Well, this line here. And it gives you a chance to figure things out. So all these tools are used, and used very effectively, to pull the wool over people's eyes. And I can believe that some of these men were doing that very sort of thing. Here, Nebuchadnezzar, just tell us what you saw, and then we'll come up with something. You know, we know you, and we'll just keep our eyes on you. We'll try to come up with something that you'll buy into. But he was going to have none of it. We've just got a few more minutes. Does anyone have any comments or questions? Yes, Eldon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there must be a pull. This sort of thing must appeal to the flesh. Yeah. Yes. Yes, Cheryl. Oh, I see. Okay, interesting thought. Yes, Dwayne.
Doesn't God sometimes allow illusions in certain situations so the people will believe a lie? Isn't that what kind of the verse talks about? Because they will, maybe I'm taking that out.
Are you thinking of the lying wonders there in 2 Thessalonians 2? It's possible. It's possible. Technically, according to that, I've got like a minute here. So let's just take verse 3. King said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. And here's where the Aramaic portion begins. O king, live forever, this respectful way of addressing him. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. Verse 5, the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you're reading out of the King James, the expression is, the thing is gone from me. The ASV and Young's Literal does something similar as well. And that's led people to conclude, in time past at least, that Nebuchadnezzar really couldn't remember the dream. That he thought, well, if someone will just tell me the dream, I'll recognize it, but that he himself couldn't remember it. I'm not a scholar, but that clearly is not the understanding of modern-day scholars on this phrase. The NAS renders it, the command from me is firm. The ESV, the word from me is firm. The NIV, this is what I have firmly decided. In other words, Darby's translation is kind of interesting. It renders it this way, the command is gone forth from me. And it seems like to me that might be the idea. That in other words, what Nebuchadnezzar is saying is, what I've just said, it's gone out of my mouth and it ain't coming back. This is the way it's going to be. So let's work together on this. And my time is up, and I thank you for your attention.